Senator Hall. Welcome to our committee.
Thank you. Do you have a microphone?
Oh, they're on the floor.
You make a good page, Senator.
It works.
Just like at home. Thank you, Madam Chair, and members. We have here before you a Senate File 2337 in the Omnibus Bill 2392, I guess, which is a wine educator bill. It's running a dual track in the Senate. And there have been some changes I just heard in the House, but that's beside the point. We're moving this forward, and it is basically a bill that is wine tasting and education for, at this point, we figure about 10 different groups that would go out and do this. At times, they have others with them that would be pouring, and so there's added cost and licensing for that, as the bill would state, but I'm not sure how much information you want as a finance committee on the bill.
Senator Hall, we always like an overview because we have to vote the whole bill out, but we do focus on the financial end of it.
So, if there's any questions on the bill?
Any questions? Senator Newman.
Madam Chair, Senator Hall, this is a proposed license to be used to purchase wine for educational purposes.
That is correct.
Explain to me what that is.
Well,
Senator Hall,
and I wish I had my star witness with me.
Sure.
Who brought this forth. They take out to homes or to restaurants, and they set up different wines, and they allow people to taste those. But to do that, you have to have a license. And so that's what we're requesting here, is to be able to have a license to be able to do that.
Senator Newman.
Senator Hall, how is that different from the wine tasting events that I would go to, say, out at a winery? And why do we... Not seeing the reason or the necessity for it, and I'm not trying to put you on the spot.
No.
I've never seen this bill before, and I don't understand it.
Senator Hall.
I'm assuming there is not a license needed for those folks, and with when she goes out to home or, and I'm not sure it's necessarily a winery, but I don't know. There are specific places that you can do it and can't do it, and she's requesting a license for those that you need to have. To get out and be able to do this with people. Right now, she can't do it without a license.
One final question, Madam Chair.
Senator Newman.
Ms. Senator Hall, who is she? Who is requesting this bill?
Jennifer Chu, and she was unable to make it here today as a witness.
Senator Hall, so it's like a wine home tasting, a home
yeah.
wine tasting party.
Yeah.
Like we go to Tupperware parties or something.
Exactly.
And they bring in the wine. They want to pass out samples of it, but they don't know that they have the ability to do that without being licensed. Although you would almost think that if the hostess or the homeowner were to purchase the wine, that they could serve the wine in their own home without being licensed. So I'm wondering if they're really the Department of Public Safety or somebody really says there needs to be a license issued for this.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah,
this is also like if you go to a retail store, a jewelry store, a clothing store after hours where they'd like to do it there. So it's not always just in a home.
Oh, I see.
And so in those cases, they need a license to do it.
Are there any other questions?
Yeah. Madam Chair, I've seen a number of events like that advertised where that's kind of the social part of a function, whether it's a fundraiser or whatever. But
right.
And that's why you're just trying to keep that, since they are dealing with liquor, that there be some registration or license to do so?
Yep.
And so, Senator Hall, there really is no fiscal impact because there would be a fee for the license, and it would cover the costs of issuing those licenses.
Right.
Is there anyone who would like to testify for or against the bill? Is there someone from public safety who might just want to clarify the necessity of this kind of a license, if this is something that people want to pursue?
Madam Chair, Michelle Tuckner, the Director of Alcohol and Gambling Enforcement. I'll do my best to try to clarify some of the questions that I heard. What the issue today is that wine educator can go into the home and can instruct about the wines. What the law doesn't allow is for them to bring the wine into the home. And Madam Chair, you are correct. The homeowner could provide the wine and the educator could come in. But if the educator wants to bring the wine into the home, the laws currently do not allow for that, and it would require something like this to allow that to occur.
Senator Newman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Could you give me the cite for that law? Or if you don't have it, provide it to me.
I certainly can, sir, yes.
Thank you.
Are there any other questions for the witness? If not, Senator Olson?
I'll be happy to do that.
Senator Olson moves that Senate File 2337 be recommended to pass. All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, nay. The motion does prevail. The bill will be placed on general orders.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
Thank you. Next up, we have Senator Dames with 2260. Welcome, Senator Dames.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. For the record, I'm Senator Dames. Today we have Senate File 2260. Senate File 2260 is a file that relates to the environment providing for alternative local standards for subsurface sewage treatment systems. The new rules and regulations were proposed a couple of years ago. There was a lot of concern and stuff by the various counties and city officials. So a year ago, we did pass a bill that put a two-year extension on before those rules and regulations went into force in order to allow the counties and the agencies to get together and work out a bill that everybody would be happy with. This is the results of that. This bill is a bill that probably nobody's really excited about, but everybody's agreeable to and everybody feels they can live with. So with those standards being in place, as I understand, it's here today because of the financial part of it. There is a $10,000 fiscal note, and the agency has agreed to absorb the cost for putting these new standards and stuff into effect out of their budget. So that is Senate File 2260.
Are there any questions for Senator Dames? Senator Nino?
Madam Chair, he just yielded.
Oh, Senator Stump.
Senator Nino, he just yielded. This has always been quite a contentious issue, and I'm wondering how they got to any sort of an agreement. Do you know what the outcome is? I was just trying to briefly look at it here. And
well, at a 10,000-foot level, what it allows is it allows the counties to use some other alternative standards that the agencies have agreed to. So it gives the county some latitude, yet the agencies have agreed to that latitude. Also, when you get into the larger systems, it has some changes there that takes a little bit of the pressure off the counties. They would still have to qualify for the larger systems, but as far as having somebody on staff that's qualified to handle larger systems, we now would not have to do that. We could use somebody from a different county or something like that.
Okay, thank you.
I think as new technologies have become available, this is important to have some more options for people, and some of them may even be better than the old technologies, and we'll see that in time, I'm sure.
Madam Chair.
Senator Nino.
Senator Dame, so is this essentially just allowing... And this approval would be at the county level, is that correct?
Senator Dames?
This Madam Chair and Senator Enow, would you please repeat that? I didn't catch
This additional flexibility, is that going to be at the county levels or at the county and city? Or at what level is that?
Senator Enow, this would be at the county level, but it still would have to be within the guidelines of what this bill is.
Okay.
But it would be at the county level.
And then, Madam Chair,
Senator Enow,
follow-up to that. So is this essentially just allowing the counties some additional flexibility for non-standard designs of ISTS or new mechanical systems? Is that basically what you're doing here?
Well, I think what it does, and we could ask the department to come up if we get too far in the weeds here, it'd be beyond my technology or my ability, but we could have the department come up. But what it does is it allows some of the blending of some of the more recent current standards with the new standards here. And it is decided at the county level, but again, like I say, it has to qualify within the parameters of this bill.
Is there anyone who wants to testify for or against the bill?
Madam Chair,
Senator Magnus.
Madam Chair, I would move Senate File 2260 to the floor.
Senator Magnus, I think we might
want to lay it on the table.
And may incorporate it into Senator Ingebrigtsen's bill in a little bit to become part of an environments bill. But before you do that, Senator Stumpf has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Clause 3, which is on line 2.26, provided the alternative standards are no less stringent than the provisions of Minnesota Rules Chapter 7080 that went into effect in 2006. is this referencing the flexibility that they have, or is this referencing some of the new technology?
Senator
Madam Chair, Senator Stumpf, Madam Chair, at this time I would request somebody from the agency to give a more detailed explanation than I may be able to give.
Good morning.
Good morning. Madam Chair, Gene Soderbeck, Minnesota Pollution Control Agency.
Welcome.
Thank you. The bill that's before you provides was to address a prohibition that existed in statute already that said alternative local standards could not exist in shoreland. It allowed it to occur outside of shoreland. And so what the bill does is it recognizes that exemption and says, but for, if you want to adopt the 2006 rules that were in place, that's fine. And Clause 3 pertained to the commercial facilities. It says that's fine to do that, provided it meets the low strength requirements that's found in the current rule. And so it provided more flexibility to get around the previous exemption that currently exists in this legislation in statutes 115-55. So, again, to highlight, what the bill does is says that where there's a prohibition, which if you read the entire section, it prohibits alternative local standards in shoreland areas. And the compromise language that came about was, to the extent that the 2006 rules are adopted for those systems less than 2,500 gallons per day, the agency believes that's sufficient to protect the environment. And then there was Clause 3, which dealt with the food and beverage industry, and we said that would be fine as well, provided it meets the low strength that's identified in the current rule.
So,
Senator Stump.
Madam Chair, so does this mean that the counties will actually get on board with these standards? Because in at least in northern Minnesota, there were a lot of counties that just basically could not or did not want to get on board with those standards before, because of the stringency of what the MPCA was trying to do in the rules. And And I would trust that if the counties are getting on board, then they would be acceptable to do that.
Welcome. Did you have an answer for that?
Yes, I do. Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Annalie Garlitz, and I'm here with the Association of Minnesota Counties. And as Senator Dame said, we spent a lot of time over the interim talking to the Pollution Control Agency, trying to figure out a way to offer some more flexibility to counties and other local units of government. And what we identified, as Senator Dame also said, this doesn't answer every single one of the questions that we had, but with every rule, there's always the implementation phase, and we do plan on talking with the Pollution Control Agency, continuing to work out this rule implementation. And this is something that the association is very supportive of. We're very pleased with the negotiation that we did have with the Pollution Control Agency to offer us this option of adopting alternative local standards within the counties. So this isn't the end. We're still going to be working with them and asking questions about the implementation as we go forward. But I do think that this will offer a fair amount of flexibility to counties when they adopt their ordinances.
Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions? Otherwise, we will lay 2260 on the table. Senator Higgins.
Madam Chair, Ms. Garlitz, are alternative local standards for other types of state regulations a common thing?
Ms. Garlitz.
Madam Chair, Senator Higgins, I'm not sure if this was under, as I understand it, the old rules. They were offered under the old rules to give counties some flexibility just because of the different soils and the different conditions that are in every county. And so they allowed counties to have this flexibility. Under the new rules, I don't know that these were available. So the Pollution Control Agency extended this option again to us to utilize under this new set of rules give us that.
Mr. Soderbeck.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Alternative local standards are always perceived as less stringent, but it goes both ways. There are many counties in the state that through the use of alternative local standards, they've adopted more stringent rules. So in terms of the flexibility, alternative local standards have been in place, I believe, since the 90s in statute. And it's not been looked at very much, but under that language, it provides the flexibilities that the counties are looking for and the agency can live with.
If there's no other questions, I understand there's a little bit of a change of plans. Because we don't know what the House is doing. We were planning to package these, but we don't know if they're taking them separately or together. So we will also we'll move this bill to the floor, and then we will also amend it into Senator Ingebrigtsen's bill, and it would be our intention that that's the way we would take it up. But just in case the House does differently, we may end up taking them individually. One of our reasons for that, members, we didn't get a fiscal note with it, but it does have a little bit of a fiscal note. But if we package these three bills together, I don't know if you saw this particular sheet that was put out. We're balanced, but otherwise we have a $10,000 note on this. So, yes, that's a big difference. I'm sorry.
And, Madam Chair,
Senator Dames,
the agency has agreed to absorb that $10,000 if that's the way it works out.
Okay. So if it would go on its own, we're okay.
That's correct.
All right. So Senator Magnus moves that Senate File 2260 be recommended to pass and be sent to the floor. All in favor of that motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, nay. The motion does prevail. The bill will be placed on general orders.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
And then we have Senator Ingebrigtsen with Senate File 1943.
Thank you, Madam Chair. As you can see, I've got my backup on both sides of me here.
He actually brings money.
That's nice. That's if this is the right committee to bring money to. Madam Chair and members, let's first start out with Senate File 1843. I'm sorry, 1943. Boy, I'm starting off really well here. Senate File 1943 is the Game and Fish provisions, which includes the newly discussed wolf management. And I think you all have something in your packet that basically goes through the bill. We're here today to talk about obviously fiscal issues. And as I said, the bill is in finance because of the fiscal impact, creating a wolf season for the first time in Minnesota. Overall cost for the general fund will be a savings of $89,000. The revenue raised will go to a population survey, population monitoring of the wolf and depredation. Minor policy provisions from the DNR and members include venison donation. There's been some talk about that. That's been revised somewhat in this bill. And removal of beaver dams and lodges by road authorities, and the annual scopes on muzzle loaders included in this bill as well. So, so members, I don't know that you want to go directly through the bill. If you have any questions, I have both policy and fiscal analysts with me. If you have any questions with regards to the bill, if you'd like Mr. Knopf to go through the bill or Mr. Mueller to talk about the fiscal ramifications, maybe we'll start there if that's okay.
I think we'd like to go through the bill first before we do the fiscal
I'll have Greg walk you through the bill. He does a great job of doing that. So,
Madam Chair, Greg Knapp from Senate Council Research and Fiscal Analysis. Section 1 deals with the Department of Natural Resources Authority, and they basically it makes it clear that one of their duties is to design to recruit new outdoor recreation participants. Section 2 deals with the harvest of bullheads, gold eyes, and moon eyes, and sheep's head and suckers for bait from streams or rivers designated as infested waters, and a kind of an allowance under certain conditions to use as bait. Section 3, this deals with the bonus permit, and it has to do with a new provision in Subdivision 7, and we'll get to that later. That's more of a technical. Section 4 is more of a technical. It's just to kind of clear up the definition of coyote to make sure to remove the term brush wolf, since we're now getting into wolf hunting in the bill. Section 5 is just an obsolete report language. Section 6 is basically a provision that for the deer feeding and wild servitude health management to have a separate report on that. That is reported as part of the annual game and fish report that the agency gives the legislature. Section 7 deals with wolf licenses, and it basically credits the money in the wolf management monitoring account, and it appropriates the money to the commissioner for that purpose. Section 8 deals with vacating refuges for open to hunting after they've been open for a number of years. It would do that. Section 9 deals with just labeling portable stands that are left for bear season on wildlife management areas. This was a bill of Senator Carlson's. Section 10 deals with basically the inability to get a license for big game when you're convicted. It does have a one-year provision if you're convicted of hunting with the use of bait.
Mr. Knopf, could I ask a question? As long as we just went past Section 9, but it says it allows options for marking portable stands. Currently, so it's just identifying them as theirs, but it doesn't. How does that rule work? Because it was always my understanding that if you're on public lands, you can't claim a spot prior. Have a permanent claim on any one location.
Yes, Madam Chair, what this does is we do have a limited allowance of this for bear sites, for bear bait sites, where you can put your stand along with your site, and you can see prior to the nearest Saturday, maybe left overnight. So this is one instance where we're allowing that stand to be left on the site overnight, And currently you have to have your name on the stand, and there are some people are concerned about leaving their names out there. And so this would allow them to either put their name and address, their driver's license number, or their Minnesota DNR license number on the stand. This is just for this limited allowance. So we did the same thing last year for the bear bait stations, and this would just make it parallel so they could label the stand and the bait station the same and just use their license number if they want to, if they're concerned about putting their name on it.
Okay. Senator Magnus, did you have a comment on that?
Yes, I do. Well, Madam Chair, another in Section 7 on the wolves, can you tell me what's the general population now of the wolves? How many we have in the state?
3,000.
Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Madam Chair, there's different estimations as to how many. We're hearing anywhere from 2,800 to 3,200. So we've been saying right around roughly 3,000 wolves.
So, Madam Chair,
Magnus,
at what level is the DNR going to try to manage this? At what number are they going to?
Madam Chair, Senator Magnus, the first year, the DNR brought forth a proposal, and admittedly they said this is going to be a conservative trial run proposal, if you will, first-year proposal. And they're asking to take the population down by 400.
Senator Ingebrigtsen, what is the birth rate on wolves? How many are typically born in an average year? I mean, if you have a population of 3,000, they have pretty big.
We have the wolf expert coming up to the table as we speak.
Hold on.
We've heard different testimony on that, and that has been discussed. As to if there's 3,000 in the pack, I guess we call them packs now. Can't call them flocks or herds, but
right,
packs.
Pack.
And they're having between 3 and 4.
But I would think each
year they're gonna go up.
Yeah, each litter would have, I don't know what an average litter size is or anything, but I would think that we could multiply pretty quickly.
Madam Chair, members, for the record, Bob Meyer, Department of Natural Resources. The success of the breeding ratios of the animals will depend on the habitat and the food available, as people know. What's important to remember, in this bill, we're only talking about the hunting and trapping season. We also have the depredation program where we do trapping where that wolf cattle or wolf livestock or wolf people, pets, conflict occur. We are taking these animals right now. So we've trapped probably over a dozen of them since the delisting occurred. And we will continue doing that where that conflict arises. We're talking specifically in this bill about a hunting and trapping season, and we want to start cautiously. Of course, we don't want these animals listed again, so you'll see the bill allows us to establish a season and manage those parameters, and we're confident that about 400 would be where we're at right now and working through that process and learning as we go. So this year, what we have set up as a season probably won't reflect what the season looks like in a couple of years, but we are working aggressively to deal with the conflicts where they're occurring in the cattle areas and in Senator Stump's district and places like that.
So what is the size of a litter?
Senator Perry.
Multitasking here, but did the question get answered about how big the litters are?
We were wondering about annual reproduction. Any idea?
Madam Chair, there's a range. It's anywhere from a couple pups to, I've seen or heard of litters as big as 8 to 10, too. Again, it depends on those environmental considerations that are there at the time that they're born and raised in that spring, how much food's available, what the weather's like, and things like that. So.
Okay. Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think it's important to remember that before the DNR started taking over the management, it was managed by the federal government, and they as well were taking, year after year after year, they were taking animals that were troublesome to cattle buyers. And I don't remember the exact number, but I want to say that in the last couple of years, they've taken over a couple hundred wolves. So.
Okay. Mr. Knopf, if you'd like to continue.
Madam Chair and members, and then also if you see paragraph C under section 10, it also would double the conviction if it's a trophy deer. That score is over 170, and that's the Boone and Crockett method that we have in rule. Madam Chair, this is a provision I was talking about earlier, and this is basically an allowance for taking antlerless deer without making a lottery application for owners and tenants of agricultural land, and so they can basically be able to take a bonus deer.
Senator Ingebrigtsen?
Madam Chair, I think it might be of interest to the committee that Minnesota has been very successful, I think, in their management of big game, and I'll give you a couple examples why. When we go back to Section 10, if you recall, maybe a year or so ago, about this deer that was poached down in the Cannon Falls area, this 8-point buck. This was a world record 8-point buck that was taken out of Minnesota. Also,
8-point.
Recently, there was a year ago, an elk in northern Minnesota, northwestern Minnesota, that actually accidentally had an accident, actually ended up dying. And that particular rack there ranged between, I understand, third and fourth in the world as far as numbers. So Minnesota is, we think about going to the western states for big game, but Minnesota's right up there with everybody else. So just a point of interest.
Thank you.
And, Madam Chair, we'll move on to Section 12, which is basically saying that, I mean, generally residents now can take, under 16, can trap without a trapping license, but what this says is this has to be other than wolves, so we're exempting wolves from the current allowance for kids under 16 to trap without a license. And then Section 13 deals with basically what needs to occur for a resident under age 10 or 11. It basically says that they must obtain a big game license without pain, and we just eliminated some language in there that, and this only applies to making sure this only applies to residents. And as you see, they have to be under direct supervision of a parent or guardian when taking. That's current law. Section 14 deals with non-residents underage, so we're separating out non-residents and residents. And basically, the non-resident must obtain a license to take big game, even if they're 10 or 11 years old, and they're hunting under direct supervision. Section 15 deals with the trapping provision, a lifetime license, and it basically says that the license for fur-bearing animals other than wolves, so we're not including wolves under the lifetime license, the trapping part of lifetime licenses. Same thing with Section 16 and Section 17 with the sporting license, that we're not including trapping of wolves as a part of that, but they can still trap other animals under their lifetime license. Section 18 is dealing with the fee right now in here for hunting for a wolf is $26 for a resident. For a non-resident, you'll see in Section 19 on page 10, it's $230 to take a wolf by hunting. And a trapping license is in Section 20, and that's $26, and that's for residents only, so no non-residents would be able to. Currently, non-residents can't trap in the state except on their own land if they own some land in the state. And what this would say is that it's that for wolves, it's $26, but only for residents. And then Section 21 is more of a technical amendment. It removes some language from a number of years ago dealing with Social Security numbers. And that, again, as you can see in the top of page 11, was January 1, 2006. Section 22 deals with the current law was taken with firearms in certain areas. What this would do is for a stockade or corral, it says that you can't shoot a firearm within 500 feet rather than just taking an animal. There was some, this was a bill of Senator Tomasoni's, and there was apparently some concern about people shooting within 500 feet that they were claiming not to be taking animals at the time or whatever. So this would extend that prohibition of the 500 feet to those. And you can see that some of this is just a rewriting of the sentence to make it clear. Section.
Mr. Knopf, when you say a corral or stockade, it doesn't include a pasture, does it?
Madam Chair, my understanding, no. This would actually be a fence, tightly fenced in area, stockade or corral, not necessarily pasture.
Okay, thank you. Otherwise, it could prohibit you from shooting in a lot of areas.
Right.
Thank you.
And then, Madam Chair, Section 23 was a bill of Senator Thompson's, and it deals with, it basically says, if you look on 11.27, that we're eliminating is on active duty and has, so that it's a person who successfully completed basic training in the United States Armed Forces would be exempt from the firearm safety certificate requirement. So anybody who's been through basic training in the service, any of the veterans would be exempt from the firearm safety certificate requirement. Section 24. We're just extending the big game, the requirement of what types of firearms and ammunition that can be used. We're extending that to wolves, the same firearms and ammunition requirement, and the same with the handguns in Section 25, making sure that when people are taking wolves, they have to, there are certain restrictions on the types, and it'll be the same types you have for big game today. Section 26, as Senator Ingebrigtsen mentioned earlier, deals with a muzzle loader, would be allowing a person with using a muzzle loader during the muzzle loader season to hunt with a scope.
Mr. Knopf, just a moment, please. I wanted to ask about that. If they are able to use scopes on muzzle loaders, are there any proposals to change the season at all? Because it is easier to hunt with a scope. Senator Ingebrigtsen?
Madam Chair, there was discussions with the DNR on that very issue because that was always the word that we were going to shorten up the season. And according to the information they've given me, it's not going to make one difference to them at all, unless I'm incorrect. But the big game specialist said it wasn't going to make any significant difference at all to change the season.
How long is the muzzleloader season typically?
I think it's a couple weeks later on. It's after the normal deer season, so it's in December, I believe. Yeah. So I think it's a two-week season.
2 weeks? Okay. I hope they're monitoring that one to see how many deer are taken, if there's a lot more with a – because those muzzleloaders don't – I mean, there's all kinds of them now, but
sure.
The traditional ones, couldn't you only put one slug in it at a time?
Madam Chair, that's all you can still put in is one slug. It's a traditional hunt. It's from the old flintlock days, and there are still those traditionalists that like to go out there and hunt with the flintlock. I think we've heard that testimony several times on the floor by Senator Bach, and we've always said go right ahead, leave the scope off and go ahead and hunt traditional. You know, there are some folks that just need the assistance of a scope, but what we're going to try and prevent, at least I think we're going to prevent, is we're going to prevent actually wounding more deer by having a more accurate shot with your muzzleloader.
Okay, thank you.
Madam Chair.
Senator Langseth.
I always thought the idea of the muzzleloading was so that we could hunt like Davy Crockett and Daniel Boone. I asked the senator if they had a scope, but he didn't answer.
Senator Ingebrigtsen.
And as I said before, and we've had these discussions in the hallway with Senator Langseth, that if they want to continue out there and hunt like Davy Crockett, I tell you, knock yourself out. We can still do that in Minnesota, and it's a great opportunity. They can also take the scopes off the very high-powered rifles that have been scoped for many, many years that shoot up to 1,000 yards now. So.
And the scopes aren't cheap, so somebody who doesn't want to spend much isn't likely to buy one. Senator Nguyen.
Madam Chair, I suspect that every person in this room that's wearing bifocals that wants to hunt with a muzzleloader would be benefited by a scope. I know years ago I put a red dot on mine, no magnification, but as we get older, our eyes are not quite as quick to adapt. So, you know, I really think that if you want to hunt in a traditional fashion, you know, go right ahead. It's just going to help some people hit what they're shooting at, that's all.
Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Madam Chair, that's not the case for me. I don't need that assistance.
He's a sharpshooter.
And he's not wearing bifocals.
The sharpshooting sheriff. Mr. Knopf.
And Madam Chair, Section 27 that just adds the wolf to the minimum draw weight that we have for big game or turkeys. Section 28, we're going to prohibit shooting big game animals within the right-of-way. And then also it provides what the types of equipment that can be or that's prohibited from use within the right-of-way. Section 29 deals with blaze orange requirements. It allows a person who's basically hunting in a stand for deer with a bow and arrow when they don't have any orange on to legally take a small game while they're in that stationary location. Section 30 deals with it just adds wolves to the restrictions on evening and morning hunting that we have now for big game. Section 31 deals with communications exceptions, because currently you can't hunt with any kind of an electronic communication device. This would allow two-way communication with a dog.
Senator Magnus.
Not yet, Madam Chair.
Oh, okay. Not yet. Continue.
And then, it also would extend that to motorized decoys for migratory waterfowl or doves. Section 32 would be a special permit for a physically disabled person to use a mounted gun. It could include like a swivel or whatever. Section 33 deals with venison donations. It exempts hunter-harvested venison donated from the food law as long as it's clearly marked as hunter-harvested venison.
Senator Magnus.
Thank you, Madam Chair. What's Chapter 31?
Food. Madam Chair, Senator Magnus, that's the food law.
So we're exempting that hunter-harvested venison from the food laws of the state. And then the second question is, it said it must be clearly marked as hunter harvested venison. Who's gonna operate and monitor that labeling? Who's gonna check on that?
Agriculture.
Senator Ingerritsen.
Madam Chair, this has become I don't think it's a highly contentious issue, but let me give a little background on it for those that don't know. The way I remember it, anyhow, being here for the 6 years, about 4 years ago, I think the law was changed where we could, and I guess there's always been an option for the hunters to donate to a special donation when you buy your license that would go to the donation program. What that means is the butchers, certified butchers or selected butchers throughout the state of Minnesota, meat producers, not producers, but butchers, would be able to receive $65, I believe, or $70 per carcass for a deer that you may not have wanted. You may have wanted to shoot three deer 1 year and decided you only wanted to keep two yourself. So when you brought your two deer your three deer into the locker plant, you donated one to the food shelf. They would butcher that deer in the same fashion, same style that they would butcher your deer. They would grind the meat and they actually did some fresh cuts as well. And the meat from the one deer that you donated would go to the food shelf. And the meat, of course, that you had brought in there, butchered in the same fashion, would go home with you. When the law came into effect, I believe, now I'm gonna go into the weeds a little bit here, but 97. Naming
2007,
putting the word food or applying this donation food into the food definition in the state of Minnesota, that required then the Department of Health, I believe.
Agriculture.
Department of Ag and Department of Health got involved in it, and what the bottom line is that every package that went to the food shelf would have to be x-rayed for lead. There was a lot of discussion in the meeting at that time. I remember there was a study done that was out in South Dakota where bald eagles had been ingesting lead from wounded pheasants that were shot with lead shot, and I don't know how many, and I don't know what the morbidity rate was with bald eagles, and then of course it got into a situation where they got into the medical aspect of things and the dangers of the possibility of children, especially young children, ingesting lead and how dangerous this could be, food donated to the food shelf after that enact of the legislature went from 75,000 pounds down to 20-some thousand pounds. So the people from the food shelf in my area came to me and said, what are you guys doing? You really kind of ruined the program here. We were just fine with the program the way it was before. So that's why I brought it forward, was to put it back to where it was and to allow the food shelves to put out the venison that same venison that you and I take home is going to be afforded the opportunity for those that are in need to come down there and pick it up and use it. There was no record, I don't think, of anybody ingesting any large amounts of lead, and I think the percentage now is down to about 6%, a very small percentage of the package that they were finding. It started out at 30%. I'm not sure why that dropped to 60, but it was very small amounts of lead that were found in some of the packages. And, of course, those packages were destroyed immediately. Again, that would be the same packages that you and I would be taking home from the locker plant. Our meat is not, the way I understand, x-rayed. So we thought it was just a good common sense thing to bring back. And but the question was, how do we monitor that? I guess, you know, I don't know the legal question of that, but I would say the food shelves were certainly more than capable of monitoring that. willing to do that, as far as I know.
Senator Ingebrigtsen, where did they get the meat x-rayed? I wouldn't think most food lockers would have an x-ray machine.
That was part of the problem, Madam Chair. The x-ray machine would have to travel. Actually, it would have to come out, and that's why not only did you see a reduction in venison going to the food shelf, you also seen a reduction in the participants. They just decided they didn't want to do that. Now, there are some other studies that the Department of Ag has done for various other reasons they got out. In fairness to them, they said that there was, well, I guess there was too much hair in the meat and things like that. But again, they're still dealing with the same carcasses that you and I are bringing in there, the same results coming out of the locker plant that you and I are taking home were being brought to the food shelf. And I understand that once they were involved in this, now all of a sudden, what's the liability going to be? Should the state of Minnesota at one time be protecting everybody at the, you know, that comes into the food shelf? And now, does the liability still go with that if we were to change this law back to where it was?
Any other questions? Okay, Mr. Knapp, do you want to continue?
Madam Chair, members, the next provision, Section 34, deals with baiting, and it does modify the, generally removes the word feed, and so we're just talking about bait or baiting. And then I think one of the most important sentences in here is 15.28, where this exclusion does not apply to agricultural crops that have been reintroduced and concentrated where a person is hunting. I don't know if anybody remembers the pumpkin case from last year, and this would prohibit the person from taking his pumpkins out and basically piling them up in front of his deer stand as the person who had that last year.
But Mr. Knapp, if the pumpkin patch happened to be there with some old pumpkins in, that would not be considered baiting?
Madam Chair, this says that they've been reintroduced and concentrated.
Okay. Thank you.
And Madam Chair, the next section 35, this again is just modifying the law. So say it's section 36 dealing with the trapping, and basically it exempts or wolves from. You can see clearly that non-residents will not be able to trap wolves even on their own property. And then in Section 36, it basically, this is, again, the resident under age 16, they would not be able to trap wolves without a small game license. Section 37 exempts wolves from the party hunting for small game. Section 38 deals with, again, this is wolves and allowing the commissioner to restrict taking of animals in certain areas. Section 39 just is more technical, removing the word gray from the wolf. Whenever we describe wolves, we're basically eliminating the term gray in front of it. Wherever it occurs, you'll see a section later that also tells the advisor to go back and change wherever else it occurs. Section 40, this is the main section dealing with wolves. Setting up the season, you have the open seasons in subdivision 2, open areas where the commissioner can by rule designate certain areas. Subdivision 4 deals with daily possession limits. Subdivision 5 deals with limiting the number of hunters and trappers in an area. in an area. Section 6, or subdivision 6, excuse me, deals with there's a $4 application fee for applying for a wolf license. That's because there will be a lottery. They'll be limiting the number of them that are allowed. Subdivision 7 allows the commissioner to set by rule the number and for the quotas. And I think a key sentence for the trappers anyways is that last one on 18.1 to 18.2, the commissioner shall reserve a portion of the annual quota for the trapping season, because the hunting season will be prior to the trapping season, and to make sure that they don't use up the entire quota during the hunting season. Section 41 deals with removal of beaver, and what this does is it removes it when road authorities have to remove a beaver. Currently, they have to get a permit from a conservation officer, and this does is it eliminates the need for the permit in advance. They still have to notify them afterwards.
Mr. Knuth, could I just ask about Section 40? Going back as I was reading that, when the DNR decides that the quota is full, and there's still people out there with unfilled licenses, and the season wouldn't have normally closed by that time, how are they going to notify people that they have to quit hunting?
Well, Madam Chair, it's my understanding that they will announce that the season, that they've reached the quota. I mean, we do this. There are other animals that they've done this before. I mean, there could be a slight overtake. I mean, 402, 403. At that point in time, but it's not. I mean, they will notify people that we're done and that they're no work. These animals will all have to be tagged, and you have to bring the carcass in. We'll get to that later. You're bringing the carcass into the wildlife officer for the department. So,
I was just wondering how the notification would work if they all needed to give email numbers or addresses or something that to make sure they got the message. And you know, you'd hate to see somebody get in trouble for taking a wolf after the quota was filled, and they never even knew the quota was filled. Senator Ingebertson.
Yes, Madam Chair, and there's a lot of discussion about this, and there are, as Mr. Knopf mentioned, there are other programs that pertain to this very type of notification. In fact, the different trapping seasons that were restricted, the trappers actually call in on a daily or bi-daily basis to see what the quota is and things like that. So people are very in tune to the electronic part of notification here, and we think it's going to work fine. And again, there might be some over. They might decide to, at 396, decide to put out the notice, giving an allowance for three or four either way. So.
Okay. Thank you. Sorry for the interruption.
And
back
Madam
to beavers.
Chair, Madam Chair, Section 42 deals with predator control payments. It eliminates the statutory dollar amount for their predator controls. This is for coyote and fox, and then it says that the fees are not subject to rulemaking. And then 43 deals with wolf control or the predator control payments. It also, if you look on 19.14, the commissioner will be basically determining by written order in the state register the amount that will be paid for predator controllers for gray wolf or for wolf. Now we're just going to call them wolf. And Madam Chair, Section 44 deals with certain upland game birds, and what it does is it eliminates the requirement. If you look on page 20, starting on line 4, current law says that the commissioner has to allow a 4-week fall season in area 601, which is a metropolitan area, and this would eliminate that and allow the commissioner more flexibility. Section 45, this deals with the hunter concealment for waterfowl, and what it does is it allows the commissioner to designate certain open water areas where people can take waterfowl in those open areas. Section 46, as I mentioned earlier, this deals with when you take a wolf, the whole carcass with the pelt removed must be presented to the state wildlife manager designee for registration. Section 47, this is a bill Senator Carlson's dealing with, body gripping traps. And what this does is it provides restrictions on certain size traps that are between 6 1/2 and less than 7 1/2 inches in diameter. What those do is it's basically the Conibear 220. I think a lot of people refer to it as. So this provides limitations. If you're larger than that, they have to be a water set. And what this does is basically says that if it either has to be in an enclosure with no greater than 81 square inches and be recessed 7 inches from the top. or it has to be, or there has to be no bait within 20 feet of the trap, or the trap has to be elevated by 3 feet above the surface of the ground or snowpack.
Senator Magnus.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I've got a question back in Section 42 when we talk about the predator control amounts the commissioner is paying on coyote and fox. I notice you're taking the set amount out. And is that to allow the DNR to better manage the especially the coyote population, Senator Ingebretson?
Yes,
Senator
that's
Ingebretson.
Correct.
Yeah, that's what. It,
that's
okay.
Right.
Good.
And Madam Chair, where we just left off, I think it bodes a little discussion, or at least a little information. As you know, I'm sure we received a lot of emails with regards to dogs that were, you know, obviously trapped and in some instances killed throughout Minnesota, and we received and took a lot of testimony with regards to these law changes here, regulation changes, and the trapping portion of the of statute. And we got a hold of the Trapping Association, which is a very large organization in Minnesota, and they did come to the table. They did work on this compromise, and we feel it's a pretty good compromise. And I don't know what the number of dogs that were taken, but there were a small amount, like 5 or 6 or maybe up to 12. I guess I did read on one of my emails. So they did respond to that. And just so you know that when you're receiving those emails and those letters, that we did respond to that, and they did, I think, a pretty nice compromise. So.
Thank you. I think all of us received some of those emails.
Yes, we did. Yeah. And, Madam Chair, members, The next two sections, 48 and 49, deal with the trout season, and this is going to give the DNR more flexibility in establishing, especially the winter season. There have been issues in the past about, especially inside and outside of the Boundary Waters Canoe Area Wilderness, and what this does is that it allows them more flexibility in that. Madam Chair, Section 50, basically the DNR it provides kind of expedited rulemaking for the restitution value for wolves. It's going to set it at $500. It's been higher than that. I'm trying to remember the amount. I think it's $2,000 in there now. And what this would do is less than that, since they're off the endangered or the threatened species list. Section 51 deals with rulemaking for the DNR for snares. It basically provides. And this is dealing with wolf, basically snares that they're allowed to take for allowance to take a wolf. And Madam Chair, Section 52 deals with the firearms wolf season for this year, the 2012, and it basically says that at least for this year it must start on the first day of the firearms deer hunting season. Section 53 is the reviser instruction to remove the term gray before wolf or wolves. And the repealer sections, Madam Chair, I don't have that in front of me right now. Thank you. The first one is hunting and fishing license reciprocity with Wisconsin. That's being eliminated. It's never worked in the past. And then Section 13 deals with collection of deer and elk in the bovine tuberculosis zone, which we don't have anymore. Section 65 deals with money received from the sale of fish and turtles, taken under refuse removal, eliminating that dedication of receipts, eliminating a specific provision on hunting on Muskrat Lake in Beltrami County. Also, it deals with a penalty relating to hunting. It's so a person who harasses or sells or possesses a gray wolf in violation of the game and fish law under current law is a gross misdemeanor, so this will go back to a misdemeanor. Section, the next one, 97, the youth deer license. This is an old, kind of an obsolete provision on a youth deer license. You saw we have some newer provisions on that. And then Section 97A552, this is a remnant of a past war with Canada over taking fish. And this was going to require, well, it was kind of a, if, for those of us who lived through that, it was because they weren't allowing us to take any limits in Canada if you were staying on the Minnesota side. So this was requiring, allowing the governor to require the fish be brought in the round back from Canada, which no one wanted to do. And then section, the next one on the gray wolves, a permit to snare. Right now, it's under current law, you cannot snare a wolf except by under permit. So this is eliminating that because now, again, we're allowing snares under for trapping. And then the last section deals with lakes with unbalanced fish populations. And all of these repealers were recommended by the agency.
Okay, questions, Senator Higgins?
Madam Chair, I'm on page 21, line 32, 33, 34. I think there's something missing in this sentence. It says the commissioner shall amend the rules to make, and then all these different kinds of trout in lakes inside and outside the boundary waters consistent with this section. I don't think that the commissioner can make the fish be consistent with anything. So I think it's the seasons for the fishing of the something else stuck in there before consistent.
Madam
Any
Chair,
recommendations?
I think that's a good catch. What I would recommend on 21.33.
No pun intended.
Yeah. 21.33 before Brown, insert seasons four.
Okay, on that amendment, all in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed, nay. The amendment is adopted. I thought there was a typo here because I have no idea what a splike is. 21.33, is some kind of a fish? So I guess it's just an unfamiliar one to me.
I'm way up north.
It's a hybrid.
I could make something up, but Madam Chair, it's a hybrid fish.
What does it look most like?
Like a trout. And if I can give you an example, you know what a sawguy is?
Yes.
Okay, it's kind of the same type of a, well, not the same kind of a fish, but that's also a fish that was bred between a sawguy
sure
and a walleye.
I'm sure my son, who's a fisheries and wildlife major, would make great fun of me for asking that question, but I had to. Any other questions? Senator Nino.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Going back to Section 29, pages 13 and 14, if I read this correctly, we're making the exemption for falconers for the blaze orange requirement, but also for someone who's hunting, bow hunting during the rifle season. Am I reading that correctly?
I'm sorry, what page was that, Senator Nino?
Pages 13 and 14. The language is on page 14.
Madam Chair, Senator Nino, as I understand it, it said basically if you're in your stand, it says only while hunting deer by archery or when small game hunting by falconry. The addition here is really just the stationary location while hunting. Now, if you're in the firearm season, you're required to wear a blaze orange anyway under the firearm season. What this is during the archery season where during the people in the field who aren't wearing blaze orange, who aren't basically trying to hide wearing some kind of a camouflage, this would allow them to take small game without having a blaze orange cap on. This is just for the small game part. If you look on the previous page, paragraph A deals with blaze orange requirements during the firearms during the firearms.
Madam Chair, I understand that, but what it says is while in a stationary location, while hunting deer by archery. Do we have small game deer?
Mr. Knapp.
No, it's just that you're basically hunting deer by archery, but it's during the small game season, and it allows you to take small game without having a blaze orange cap.
Why would we do that?
Okay. I'll take your word for it.
Is there still the requirement that they have to put on blaze orange as they're walking to and from their stand?
Well, Madam Chair, that would just be during the firearms deer season. Again, that we're not amending that at all. That's still paragraph A, and it basically says a person may not hunt or trap during the open season where deer may be taken by firearms under applicable law. So that's that we're just leaving that as current law.
Thank you. Any other questions?
Madam Chair.
Senator Bonner.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And, I apologize for being late, and so you I may be asking a question that isn't needed, but I just want to check because I've learned over the years that sometimes things are buried in a bill, and I want to make sure it's not in there. I've heard a lot from people in my community about an issue regarding the youth firearm safety course and wanting access to the same firearm safety or the range that the police are using. Is that anywhere in these bills?
Senator Ingebrigtsen?
No, Madam Chair, no, it's not. But that's it's a bill that I'm carrying, and,
okay.
and it's becoming very controversial. So, no, it's not in here.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
So if we don't have any more questions on the bill itself, let's go to the fiscal note. Mr. Mueller, do you want to go through that with us, please?
Madam Chair, I have handed out, or there should be in your packets, a sort of a overall tracking sheet for all the bills that we're looking at today. It's titled Senate Environment and Natural Resources Bills and Finance Committee, and it's just trying to take all the information from all the different fiscal notes and get it down to one page that's maybe easier to work off of. In this bill, Senate File 1943, basically the only fiscal issues in this bill deals with the new wolf hunting season. You'll see on line one of this one page is the revenues expected due to the new wolf hunting license, and that'll be $256,000 per year. That includes the application fees, $4 paid by everyone who's applying for a license, and then $26 for everyone who's awarded the license. So there's $256,000 coming in, and the bill establishes a new account in the Game and Fish Fund that this money will go into. And it also has a statutory appropriation that right now the DNR is expecting to spend $167,000 of new money. Sure. They are already spending some money on wolf management, about $65,000, and that actually comes out of one of the lottery in lieu accounts. So they may have a bit of a surplus at first, but their long-term plans, depending on what the management costs of the wolf really are, we'll have the authority to spend the whole amount of money coming in from the wolf fees. So that's pretty much it for this 1943 as far as fiscal issues.
Are there any questions about that? I noticed, Senator Ingebrigtsen, I thought originally from reading something that the wolf license fee was going to be $50, and now it's $26, so they decided that they don't need that account to be as big as maybe they originally thought.
Madam Chair, there was a lot of discussion with regards to the first proposal that was out there. We just, in consultation now with the House, to try and line things up with them a little bit before we get to the conference committee, but we felt that it should stay in the range of the deer license. We thought $50 was a little high.
Senator Magnus?
Madam Chair, I'm still have some concerns about the wolf depredation that we see, and so I was wondering if you have anything in the bill that requires the DNR set some parameters out for their reporting and how they manage that, or are you just turning it over to the department?
Senator Ingebrigtsen?
How they're going to manage the wolf population. And this sort of thing. Because, Madam Chair, you know, we have some wolf depredation funds in the ag budget for some of the areas up north for the cattlemen and sheep folks. And so I do have some concerns about that. I don't want to drag the committee out here, Senator Ingebrigtsen, but
Mr.
just a thought Madam on Chair, how they're going to do
it. Yeah, Madam Chair, if I could have Bob Meyer comment with regards to that.
And I don't want to hold your bill up, but
Madam Chairman, members, Senator Magnus, Bob Meyer again, DNR. Right now, we're entering into a cooperative agreement with Wildlife Services out of Grand Rapids to do that depredation programming with money we were appropriated last biennium, $100,000. That'll hopefully take us through the calving season into the fall. We will be budgeting approximately that amount again out of these revenues to do that.
Okay.
But we need to continue working on that. We're working with the Cattlemen's Association and the Department of Agriculture to determine what the future of that program looks like. So we'll continue working with you all and keep you informed on those discussions.
Okay, thank you. Is there anyone in the audience who wanted to testify for or against the bill, especially focusing on the fiscal impact?
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Greta Gothier. I'm with the Department of Agriculture. Excuse me for my froggy throat today. I just wanted to testify on Section 33 of the bill, the venison donation section, just to be on the record that the Department of Agriculture is not in favor. We oppose the exemption of any food from the food safety statutes. Our department was created in 1885, and in 1889, the legislature gave us authority over food safety in Minnesota. We take that authority very seriously. We are the delegate of the Federal Food and Drug Administration in Minnesota, and in 133 years since we've been working on food safety, as far as we can tell, nothing's ever been exempted from the food code. We think this is a dangerous path. It would not allow us to be involved in any way in the determination or any procedure with the venison. It's true the venison does have to be x-rayed before it goes to the food shelves now. Prior to that requirement, we did try working with the butchers, and we were able to reduce some of the amount of lead in the meat, but not all of it. And the Center for Disease Control, the standard for allowable venison in humans is zero. So we are obligated to follow the federal food code, which is not supportive of exempting any item of food from it. I just want to be on the record that we're not in favor of that language. I'd be happy to try to answer more questions if the committee would like, but we did testify fairly fully in the Environment Committee.
Ms. Gauthier, you haven't exempted any food, but is that always food for sale, or is that food that's also given away?
Madam Chair, sale under the statutes includes food that is given away. The definition of sale includes food that is given.
I think to clarify,
Senator Magnus.
Madam Chair, I think if you go through a third party. So if Senator Ingebretson shoots a deer for me and gives the meat to me, I think that's okay. I'm accepting it directly from him. But I think what triggers this is if you go through a third party.
Ms. Gauthier?
Madam Chair, Senator Magnus is correct. The philosophy, if you will, is personal responsibility. So the food that you eat, that you hunt, that you grow, you can eat, and if you want to give it to your friend or your neighbor who knows you and knows the way you grow your food or knows the way you make your pickles or whatever, that's fine. But once you start moving food that's made by one source to another group of people that have no knowledge of the people who produce the food or process the food, that's where you have to have some assurance that the food is safe to eat.
So, Ms. Gauthier, the requirement that it be x-rayed is still in place, but there would be some other standards that you would currently want to have in place that won't be, but the person who picks it up at the food shelf will be told that it's hunter-harvested venison, and that would be their clue that it might not have gone through the same standards as other food products.
Madam Chair, if under the current language, Chapter 31 is the core food safety laws, if this if venison is exempted from that, we would have no more x-raying, we would have no more of any involvement in the movement of the venison from the time the animal's killed to the time it's in front of the food shelf's recipients.
Senator Bonner?
Madam Chair, Senator Ingebretson, this bothers me hearing this testimony because I think that if there was a tag that said hunter harvested venison, that would not tell the person who was not educated in what that symbolizes that, oh, there could be lead in this. And so I don't understand what you're thinking is why you want to do this given the testimony by Ms. Gauthier. It seems to me that it would be safest to take that section out. What's your thinking, Senator Ingebretson?
Madam Chair, again, I certainly understand the liability that's being, brought up here for the food with the identification of it being food. But again, please understand that the venison that deer that I bring there and gets processed in the same manner is going to come back to me with no label. It has been doing that for years. This same venison now is going to go to the food shelf as a donation with a label on it saying it's hunter harvested venison. Could possibly contain lead. We talked about that, putting that on the label. That was not satisfactory, because then you're really, I don't think the state wants to put that kind of a label out on anything that they have anything to do with regards to processing meat. So I understand that. But there certainly becomes a certain amount of responsibility when you, it would seem to me, when you go to the food shelf by the folks that are working there maybe, and also the people that are receiving the food, that you may have to take a little bit of risk if you're going to consume the venison that your neighbor is consuming, that may have been the guy or the gal that shot the deer. So I just don't think it's an unreasonable request. And with the amounts of venison that went down with this program was instituted, just tells me that, I mean, there's definitely a need out there for this with the food shelves. That's why my food shelf person came to me and said there was nothing broken here. What you fixed, you actually broke, because we went from 75,000 pounds down to 20-some thousand. And I just thought that was quite astounding. And again, no, I don't know if they can come up with anybody that ingested lead to the point where they got sick. I don't know if we can even trace that. Maybe maybe we can. I don't know. But that doesn't mean we should go out there and ingest people with lead either. So I understand your concern.
Senator Ingebrigtsen, follow up.
Senator Brown, I was just wondering if we should expand the warning just to say that it's hunter harvested venison that is not inspected or certified.
I was going to, on that same line, I think that we should be more clear and say hunter harvested venison and may contain, I think you should say may contain lead or bullets. I mean, I know when I eat something that's been shot, my family hunts, I spit out a bullet every now and then. It sounds gross, but, I mean, I think that perhaps it should be labeled that way.
I think they should comment.
Look at the look I'm getting from Senator Cohen.
I think we've all eaten food. Yes. Well, maybe not all. But I've eaten feathers, spur. I mean,
right.
Madam Chair, I think she'd like to answer that.
Ms. Gautier?
So when you do that, then it lays this open.
Madam Chair, in 2008, North Dakota did a study of the venison harvested in their state and found about a third of it contained lead shot that was going to food shelves. We did a study here in Minnesota and found 26%. We did the mandatory training for participating butchers. We said you can't donate animals that have extensive damage from ammunition. It got down to about 6%. But the healthy tolerance or the healthy level is zero, so that's why we put into place the X-ray. Under this bill, we wouldn't have any authority to educate people about a label or enforce it in any way. So I don't really have a comment on how you might want to change the language there, because that wouldn't be under our purview under this bill.
Madam Chair.
Senator Stump.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a different tact. Isn't there some substitute for lead bullets?
I have a bill.
Senator Ingebrigtsen. Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Yes, there is, Senator. Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Stump, there is a new bullet that's come out now. Very, I would say, cost prohibitive to most people, but there is a bullet the social norm is changing. It's just taking a long time. I remember the comment a couple of years ago when we were talking about going from lead to brass bullets, and the Deer Hunters Association said there are literally train cars of lead bullets still in Minnesota. That would be a social change that would be, take a lot of time. But you know what? It is changing, and there are a lot of folks that are using those bullets now that are not putting lead out there. However, upland game, of course, again, is still allowed to take with lead versus the waterfowl. Waterfowl now has to be all steel. So again, it's just taking a long time to do that, and for whatever reason, there's not the killing power they say in birds with steel than there is lead. So, but that is there. Another question, another point of interest I might have: the special hunts that we've had throughout the state. Most of those are sharpshooters, like Senator Langseth, and I think most of those animals are shot even in the head, and I think when they're donated, I think they also have to be X-rayed. The meat has to be X-rayed. Now, there can't be any fragments, I don't think, in the hindquarters if they're shot in the head. At least I don't think there is. So that's kind of where we've gone with this, and I just think it's a little bit of a...
I don't want
to say overkill, but I'll say overreach.
And deers that are shot with bow and arrows have no lead in them, and that's getting more and more common. There's more bow hunters out there than there ever were.
Yeah. And Madam Chair, I think she just told me North Dakota's donation program is only archery, but I also have information that Wisconsin and Iowa have a donation program there where they do not X-ray. So,
Madam Chair.
Senator Higgins.
Madam Chair, Senator Ingebrigtsen, I think part of the problem is just by saying it's hunter-harvested venison, it may not be enough of an indicator or not enough of a message to the recipient to know to look extra careful at it and spit it out if necessary. But I'm thinking, you know, between here and when we take this up on the floor, maybe there's some more clarifying language that can be done.
Sure.
You know, maybe a sign at the food shelf, maybe a something.
As long as you're still accepting.
I think something that says not inspected or certified should be maybe put on the packages.
Bullets.
Right. I know when we raise domestic ducks, and you know, we have those in the freezer, and then we have ducks in the freezer that were hunted. And I like to know which one I've got out to know if I have to be careful when I'm chewing or not, because some you don't have to worry about, and some you better think about it a little bit. Senator Stump.
Last night on the news, they were talking about, I think it was one of the retail or wholesalers and distributors in Minnesota pulling their
pink slime.
So we've been eating pink slime for I don't know how many years
in our schools
and all over in the meat, and it was disgusting.
It is disgusting. Have you ever had it?
Oh. Well, I don't know.
Well, members, I wanted to be done with this bill by 10 o'clock for sure, and I'm hoping some of you have a little extra time to stay because session doesn't start until 11. Oh, you have caucus. We wanted to get through a couple more bills here. So, Senator Ingebrigtsen, do you want to make a motion to move this bill forward and then also keep it here?
Yes, that's the motion I'd like to make. And Senator Higgins, I'd be more than happy between now and the floor to work with that and some wording with you and Senator Bonnoff.
We've been doing that a lot.
So I'd make that motion, both here as well.
Senator Ingebrigtsen moves that Senate File 1943 be recommended to pass and as amended and referred to the floor. Place on general orders. All in favor of that motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, nay. The motion does prevail. Senate File 1943 is placed on general orders. Do you want to try and take up one more quickly? And then we may have to take up the last one tomorrow morning right before we take up Senator Olson's bill. Would that work?
Boy, I'm at the mercy of the chair. This one is a fishing fees, fishing and hunting fee increase.
Sure.
Senator
Olson.
So you are going to try to keep going now because this is running up against
our regular time.
What's the other one?
You're supposed to go to caucus. We actually will have several hours tomorrow morning if we start at 9, if you've kept your schedules cleared, from 9 to 11 at least.
Okay.
And so far we only have Senator Olson's bill on the agenda, that has to deal with the payback for the school shift. If we might want to switch a couple more over, I know we have the commissioner here. He's maybe interested in this fee bill. I don't know if
that's a long one.
It might take a little while to get through that, though, and I don't want to keep losing members. So we will put that at the top of the agenda tomorrow morning.
What's that?
And we'll probably have to adjourn for today. Sorry about that, Senator Ingebrigtsen.
So this will start at 9 tomorrow morning?
9 o'clock tomorrow morning.
That's fine.
Okay.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
Okay, with that, the meeting is adjourned.